Feed me, Seymour! In honor of Little Joe, what's cinema's most memorable plant?
I'm Katie Rich, and I'm going with the plant that Wally finds in Wally.
I'm Matt Hatches, and I'm going to go with Timothy Green from The Odd Life of Timothy Green. Wasn't he? He was a plant. I think he
was a child who turned into a plant.
I thought he was a plant.
Or a plant who turned into a child. I guess
either way, he's coming out of the fucking ground.
Certainly memorable. I'm David the Seven, and I'm going with the rose from Beauty and the Beast. It's the ticking clock. Ticking rose.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 282, and it is the week of Wednesday, December 4th, 2019. That was the day that in 1954, the first Burger King opened in Florida. For some reason, I know that the first McDonald's opened in 1955. I didn't know that Burger King came first.
What is the name of the Burger King kids meal? What is the Happy Meal equivalent and Burger King?
Kids meal.
It's just called Kids Meal. Kids.
You want it to be like a little king, like a prince meal?
Yeah, prince meal. That would be good.
Yeah, let's get on that Burger King. We are still here without David because David is off enjoying his newborn baby, which puts Patches in charge of reviews. What we got?
It's light this week, but as I saw someone going on a Twitter rampage about over the Thanksgiving holiday, apparently iTunes reviews don't really matter. They don't really help you, but they're actually a great way of us communicating with our audience, and our audience getting to tell us what to read on air in the beginning of the show. And this one is short and sweet. This one's from Haber345. It says, love this podcast. Know who the best is. 5 stars. Charlie. Charlie is the best. Katie's responsible for the best critic alive.
Yes.
Congratulations, Katie.
Oh, how does this guy feel knowing that Charlie's been watching Frozen 2 on a loop? Does he have critical thoughts?
Maybe he's doing a deep read.
He was telling me today about how Olaf does a lot of really funny things. So, I don't know.
He seen the post-credit scene in Frozen 2?
No, actually, I haven't seen it. We have yet to watch to the post-credit scene, so maybe that's what we got to get on.
That'll radically shift his opinions on Olaf.
On Olaf? Oh, God.
The idea of death. Have you talked about the idea of death with Charlie?
Has
it come up?
We've talked about things that have died, but I don't know that I don't think he grasps it.
There's a lot of death.
We haven't
had
like
Frozen
people in our lives die, so it's all very abstract.
Right, but I mean, Olaf dies.
I know.
Frozen 2. I guess that's a bit of a spoiler. No, well, the reverse spoiler is he comes back to life, and nothing matters. Fucking stupid.
The reverse spoiler is nothing matters.
The real spoiler of life.
That's actually the review of The Irishman.
Yeah, I was about to say, we'll get there.
Okay, leave us reviews.
People can leave us more reviews. Yeah, I mean,
Please tell me more of what you think about. I will try to bring more Charlie film opinions and figure out what he thinks about the post-credit scene in Frozen 2. I'll report back.
What's the best thing that people can do to help get the podcast out there? Is it like unsubscribe and resubscribe? Like a mass
hire a foreign company that has people that artificially inflate your numbers.
Okay, so leave us a review or hire a third-party company to do diabolical work.
Written a best of the decade list, and I probably won't because I find the prospect daunting and the idea of defending like anything in my top tens from many years ago is terrifying. Because
well, David's not here to nag you about Foxcatcher, so I guess it's our job.
I mean, I rewatch Foxcatcher thanks to this podcast, and I think I don't know if it holds up as number one movie of the year. I think it holds up anyway. What I was thinking about, for some reason, the movie Stoker came into my brain recently, maybe because I was drinking red wine, which is like the theme of that movie. And that feels like a movie that was critically acclaimed when it came out. Patches, you and I saw it at Sundance. It had this big launch. It didn't do especially well. It wasn't an awards player. It didn't make a lot of money. So there's a reason that it would be under the radar. But as people kind of go and dig up films from the decade that they want to talk about, like that has not come up at all. It feels like completely ignored, both by critics and audiences, and like it's basically been forgotten, which to me is a bummer. And I feel like there's movies like that. What's that?
Why do you think that is? What defines Stoker as, like, too far under the radar that our critic pals aren't digging it up or that people haven't talked about it? Has it been out there to, like, stream? I feel like that must be an important part of resurrecting.
I feel like a bigger part of it is, like, any of us who go back, we're like, look at our top tens, we look at the Oscars, we look at other people's top tens, and, like, Stoker was well-liked, but, like, it didn't necessarily make a lot of people's top tens. I believe it made mine. I'm, like, digging mine up.
It made yours, yeah.
It was number nine on my list. Right after Pain and Gain, another movie I feel like has been forgotten. If it's something that falls in the middle, if it's something that like wasn't a big hit that people are gonna like dig up, like no one wants to like hear a podcast episode about Stoker, even though they should. So it just kind of falls in there. Like another one that I thought of that was on your top 10 and when it came out was Anomalisa, which I had literally forgotten ever came out until it showed up for me on Twitter today.
The animated Charlie Kaufman film.
Yes. Which it played at the Toronto Film Festival. I think it was nominated for the animated feature Oscar, or at least it was like in the running there. But again, it's like it really feels like it's fallen through the cracks.
Do you think it's fallen through the cracks? I mean, certainly all of Charlie Kaufman's movies seem to persist except Anomalisa. And I wonder if the medium has something to do with that. I wonder if the like male pathos has something to do with that, that we're like not in the mood to remember what Anomalisa is about or what it dwells on. Do you even remember the plot of Anomalisa?
It's like white guy in a hotel in Cincinnati, like feeling ennui, basically.
Yeah, and like having an affair, and there's that big doll sex scene.
I forgot there was an affair.
Team America. I don't think it's what people really want to talk about. So much to Charlie Kaufman's dismay, I don't think Anomalisa is going to be in the conversation.
Yeah.
Dave, what movies come to your mind?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because both Stoker and Anomalisa were previously my number ones on top 10 lists for this podcast.
Oh, my God. I did not do that to target you specifically, Dave.
No, those are some good ones. My ones are ones that I remember fondly and that I still think are good movies, but are probably going to be forgotten because they're not like absolutely great movies. But when they came out, I remember at least some discussion around them. That I was participating in. One is Attack the Block.
Yeah.
Which I think was like a huge fun action movie when it came out. And then, you know, John Boyega became part of Star Wars. And now it's sort of like a footnote.
It's a footnote people will always point to. Like every time John Boyega does something, we'll talk about Attack the Block. I feel like Attack the Block is safe every time.
I don't know. I worry about that falling into like the background of the backstory because it'll be like John Boyega of Star Wars, and it might end there.
Well, like, what was Mark Hamill doing
before Star Wars, and what do you know about it?
The other thing about Attack the Block is that whenever Joe Cornish makes a movie, because he makes so few, that movie will get dug up because it was such a career igniter. Like everyone wanted Joe Cornish to make a movie or like a big franchise movie. I think he was going to do Snow Crash. The king who must be the kid who must be king flopped. Yes, maybe it did flop, but I watched it on an airplane and there were undead and there were sword fights and it was pleasant.
Yeah, it took him 8 years to make a follow up. It came out this year, and I had forgotten all about it.
It came out this year and nobody talked about Attack the Block. So hypothesis disproven.
Excuse me. I think that Polygon wrote about Attack the Block. I'm just gonna throw it out there.
Okay, good job. You did your job correctly. I approve. Second movie of the past 10 years is a little animated film called Rango.
Mm, did love Rango.
That I think is like a Gore Verbinski like making a little animated movie to entertain himself that it actually works. Thank you for sending me that Polygon link, Patches. It's very informative. But yeah, I think Rango kind of gets overlooked. I think it kind of got sucked up in the Johnny Depp backwash, and that's a movie that a lot of the animation was done off of live action reference, right on the cusp of actual performance capture becoming a thing. So it's sort of like this weird movie that I think worked really well for the system that it was in and is still very enjoyable, but doesn't have a reason to be revisited in the future outside of just being kind of a fun animated movie that has some Western pastiche tropes. They're doing good for like The Mandalorian now or whatever.
Remember when the Western was back? I was talking to someone who is close to like ILM people about why ILM never made another computer animated movie after Rango, because Rango was so, I think, wait, did Rango win the Oscar that year? It may have.
Oh, God.
Katie will look that up. That, yeah. She needs to know that trivia anyway for other jobs. And then I realized they did make another 3D animated movie called Strange Magic, which
no one remembers
that movie. That's a George Lucas idea about, like, trolls, and it's a musical with original music by, I can't even remember, but I think his old sound designer, Gary Rydstrom, directed it. A very strange product.
Strange Magic.
To come and go. Strange Magic product.
Ringo did win the Best Animated Feature Oscar.
Hey, Patches knows some Oscar trivia.
Nice. And then my last one is one that I'm always kind of like beating the drum for, but I totally know why it's not revisited, because who needs to talk about sexually frustrated men who are maybe stalking a girl? It is Swiss Army Man. The Daniel Radcliffe plays a corpse with a erection that points the direction home. But yeah, I think it's a story that deals with those issues in a very thoughtful and then ultimately silly way instead of like a dark, violent way. And I still think the soundtrack is amazing. It's all based on the human voice and vocal performances from the stars. Yeah, I don't know. I understand why people don't like it, but I always will.
Yeah, it seems to be a trend that the big Sundance premieres that still get a lot of buzz when they come out don't have longer legs into the future.
Yeah, here's a movie no one will ever remember. Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Didn't David write a long essay about that film and became very emotionally attached, even though it kind of sucks?
David loved Me and the Girl and the Dying Girl. I have a theory. I have a hypothesis that you might be able to immediately disprove. I think that no studio comedies from this decade will be remembered except Bridesmaids and maybe a Kevin Hart movie.
Well, now you have me wondering what else. When did The Hangover come out?
2009. And, like, the sequels came out this decade, but, like, I don't think anyone will ever think about those.
No, the sequels are non-existent, but The Hangover will remain.
Like, I found in 2011, the movie Hall Pass was the top grossing movie one weekend. It's, like, Owen Wilson and Ed Helms. Like, that movie doesn't exist. Studio comedies were just brutal, mostly. It's kind of a dying genre this decade.
What do you think?
And, like, and Kevin Hart movies have done well, like, but I don't think any of them... Kevin Hart movies will be remembered because I think Kevin Hart will be remembered because he's like a significant star, but I don't think any one of his movies will stand out.
I was just about to say Pineapple Express, but that was a
2008
movie. Wow. Yeah, what comedies came out?
I mean
people went hard for Game Night,
one.
But that's not going to happen.
No, I mean Game Night was one of those movies that like people liked, but I mean, do you want to count the Jumanji movie? Like that was kind of a comedy.
I'd rather not, no.
I mean, like, Deadpool, like, it's just, like, comedy, studio comedy has been kind of, like, subsumed into other genres, and...
Yeah, wow.
It's crazy, right?
Here's my big question, thinking about, like, what we were talking before the show, I think the most notable movies that we'll come up with in this thought experiment are going to be the ones that felt the biggest when they came out and then totally disappeared from conversation, and I'm trying to think of the biggest one. And I'm wondering if you think Gravity is something that people actually think about and talk about today, or if it was such a burst of technological wonder and thrill and had to be seen in the theaters that because those circumstances didn't allow it to kind of thrive on cable or on streaming, and people don't really talk about it now. It's kind of almost Avatar-like. But do you think Gravity had, because of Roma, did Roma reignite Gravity Fever? I don't think so.
I don't know that Gravity is being seen by people, but I think that it, like, its existence will be known. Like, I think it will, like, have its
what,
spot
though?
In the history of technology and blockbusters and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm finding myself referencing it a lot, talking about things that, like, The Mandalorian's doing. With projecting false backgrounds so that it could have like proper reflections and light. What was it? The Tom Cruise movie Oblivion also was like a step in that direction, but it kind of started with Gravity and their little rig to make 3D environments project correctly onto the actors.
And what about all
of the... But you might be right in terms of like people talk, normal people talking about it, because that's not a normal conversation to have.
What about all the non-Hugh Jackman X-Men movies made this decade?
I mean, like, none of them
X-Men
were
X-Men First Class. And, yeah. I mean, but they were all like, I mean, X-Men First Class was like, well, very well received. It felt like a good start to a franchise, and that whole franchise just went nowhere and seems pretty clearly to be over at this point.
Yeah, but the resurrection of X-Men whenever Marvel does something with it will always keep those movies in the conversation. We'll always be looking back and wondering which ones were really good. People will process and reprocess them. It's really hard to erase superhero cinema at this time.
Well, you're going to forget Hugh Jackman movies, like non-superhero cinema Hugh Jackman movies.
Yeah, well, no one's going to forget Circus Showman. Musical, whatever that was called.
You remember his turn as Blackbeard in Pan?
The movie Katie I talked about on This Had Oscar Buzz a week ago.
That's right.
Indeed, that's the one. Or he made an appearance in Movie 43, a studio comedy that, or not even a studio comedy, I don't think. I think it was like Indeed. What, like, sketch movie?
Oh, right.
The voice of Bucky in Rise of the Guardians.
Yeah. What?
He had balls on his chin, if I recall correctly.
I heard about it.
Yes, yes.
What about Oz the Great and Powerful?
Oh, yeah. I did not remember that existed.
Yeah,
that
I had to scroll through some 2013 box office. That movie stars Rachel Weisz and Michelle Williams and, like, many famous and valuable people and does not exist.
And James Franco?
And James Franco. I was not counting him as a famous and valuable person.
Oh, wow. Well, we don't like him that much anyway. But as far as like the biggest, do you think that The Hunger Games has any
lasting
impact?
I was
going to
bring up
impact?
The Hunger Games.
I think that is the franchise that no one will talk about, no one will remember, has no legacy, fizzled out so quickly.
Well,
it's
you kinda, I mean, Divergent, I would say, would be more forgotten than Hunger Games.
But Divergent wasn't big. Divergent died off after the first movie, and just because they kept making them, we need to find something that's like the big pendulum swing. It feels like a zeitgeisty moment. Everyone is going to see Jennifer Lawrence. Everyone's going to see this YA franchise. It's spawning its own knockoffs like Divergent. Hunger Games was big, except then it wasn't.
And I think Twilight has a legacy that Hunger Games does not.
Oh, for sure. I am going by the end of the year. I'm definitely going to finally publish my piece about why Breaking Dawn 1 and 2 are a masterpiece. They're really good movies. Oh my god!
But they're not. They're not Mockingjay Part 1 and 2.
No. Katie may have still been in New York when those came out. Those movies were bad. They're just so lifeless. Francis Lawrence and like drifting IMAX cameras and no pointless action scenes. The last movie is.
I remember almost nothing about The Hunger. Like, I read The Hunger Games book, so like I remember the plots, but like I don't really remember anything about the movies themselves.
Splitting the second movie or the third movie up into two movies was the ultimate. Like, just erase this movie from history. We'll never remember either part now. Really.
Well,
sad.
What about there's also the Fantastic Beasts franchise, which will eternally be a footnote.
We're forgetting it before it even happens. That's the most amazing thing. It's true.
We're only two movies into that five movie saga.
Oh,
I'm holding out hope.
I never saw the second one. Just didn't need it.
Here's to the next decade, I guess. Or what's the movie from this year that you've already forgotten?
What is? should we end on that? What is the movie from this year you've already forgotten?
Yeah, I'm like. What?
Well, no I think pressure. Patches is maybe not his number one movie of the year, definitely in his top three. A fantastic movie named Loose about an adult playing a teenager and racial attitudes. It is.
Damn it.
It is secretly a sequel to The Orphan.
People see Loose.
What is the movie from this year? There was a How to Train Your Dragon movie this year.
The score is amazing.
Yeah, with a female dragon.
I don't know. I didn't see it. Or does it have to be a movie like I've seen years? That I've forgotten about? Because that's going to be harder.
Oh, remember the puppet movie by friend of the show guy we had on our Clue episode?
Happy Time Murders?
Melissa McCarthy. Happy Time Murders.
That was last year.
That was last year?
I think so.
Oh, my life.
How about Minute Black International?
No oh, shit. Yeah.
That is probably.
That one went away. That one went away real fast, yeah.
Well, here's to remembering.
We'll get to our top tens later. Men in Black International will be on all of our top tens, probably.
Nope. No, solidly number 10 across four.
Even David's.
I can hear you, but I won't. Some look for trouble, while others don't. There's a thousand reasons I should go about my day and ignore your whispers, which I wish would go away. Oh.
Hey, Patches, you know what the difference between this week and last week is?
I've seen Knives Out.
Woo!
That's correct.
Guess it.
Cling. So we're going to give
a holster.
Ching! We're going to have a little mini segment here to talk about Knives Out with spoilers. If you haven't seen the whodunit, skip this segment. Look down your notes and check out the time code for segment 3, because it is a mystery and has a lot of twists in it. Patches, what'd you think of Knives Out?
I mean, it's kind of made for me, right? There's literally a scene where they watch Murder, She Wrote, as we referenced, in Spanish, which I really love, because that's not the way I traditionally watch Murder, She Wrote. But in other things that aren't related to Murder, She Wrote, I mean, I thought this was exactly what the promise was. It's a whodunit with lots of twists and solid performances. I thought, you know, I don't think Rian Johnson has ever made a great movie. I don't know if that's a controversial opinion. Not, I mean, they just don't.
We said on last week's episode that you've blocked out of your memory that we think this is the best movie he's made.
Yeah, and I think Last Jedi is still the best movie that he has made, and that this is close second. The beginnings, all the intros of the characters are fantastic. The middle sags for me a bit. I'm not sure that Ana de Armas, who plays Marta, the nurse, the caretaker, is a strong enough lead. So much of the movie falls on her shoulders, which is really exciting. I like following it from her perspective and her, this is full spoiler, so she is obviously the culprit, right? She committed the murder, or so we think, for most of the movie. That's an interesting twist, and then to kind of reverse who done it in the end is a really clever twist. And I think Knives Out, no matter what you think of the middle, even as it kind of spins its wheels, and maybe Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc isn't as funny as he should be.
How dare you?
And the rest of the characters kind of get lost. I mean, everyone just kind of drifts away. That's upsetting. Michael Shannon's really funny in this. There's definitely not enough Jamie Lee Curtis in this movie. There's definitely not enough Toni Collette doing goop.
Yeah.
Guru shit. I just wanted more of every single person in this movie. Where is, Jacob Tremblay in this movie? Jaden Martell playing. He played Jacob Tromby.
The Nazi child?
I mean, he doesn't get any lines. He's playing this alt-right kid. That seems like a hilarious premise that does not get mined at all. It's interesting how everyone falls away, and it's really focused on Marta. And, yeah, And Chris Evans. I mean, when he re-enters the film, that's when it's totally re-energized. And by the end, you walk out no matter what. It's just so clever. It's so funny. And that's what I really want to talk about in this, since we already talked about Knives Out. Just like, how do you think, like, is the movie great or is the ending perfect? Can you tell the difference? Because it's so, even like when we realize that Chris Evans is the killer and he goes for the knife, and that turns out to be a twist too. Like, oh, it's going to be a fake knife. He can't actually kill anybody. It's just so satisfying. And I wonder if the whodunit genre manipulates us in that way. If you can get across the finish line, do you have a great movie on your hands? Will you always watch it? This is how I feel about Murder, She Wrote sometimes, which can meander quite a bit, as you can imagine. And all you really need is some funny character setups, and you need to see Jessica Fletcher solve the mystery in the end. The middle of it hopefully will sustain your attention until the very end. And that seems to be the risk of these movies. And I think Knives Out's pretty successful as far as its genre company is concerned. But I have to say it's pretty slack and a little boring in the middle. But my God, the end is perfect.
I never found the boring middle. the middle boring. I hear what you say about, especially like Toni Collette and Michael Shannon not being in it enough. It does feel like there's something established with the family that it can't keep up with. But I just don't think it matters that much when there's so much else going on that's good. I think Daniel Craig is really funny and he like held me with it the entire time. I mean, I saw it at a premiere audience in Toronto who are going to be like primed to like it. So my opportunity for my attention to drag was pretty limited, but I didn't feel like it dragged, even if it's maybe not as airtight in the middle segments as it gets at the end.
There's a lot of puking.
A lot of puking in a Hustlers. That's good, though.
So, puking. What's the third film in the puke trilogy of 2019? Well, just to wrap up this mini segment, now that I got to praise Knives Out a little bit, and really all my hats, my detective hat is off to Chris Evans, especially, who's just a riot in this movie, and it feels like a sequel to his, Scott Pilgrim performance in some way. Do you want to see more Benoit Blanc in movies? I saw a lot of people. Knives Out made a tremendous amount of money. It made $40 million, or maybe even more than that, worldwide, $70 million.
Oh my God.
This weekend, which is almost double its budget, which is great. This is not based on anything. This is just Rian Johnson's obsessions funneled in to a playful thriller romp. This is exactly what people hope will do well at the box office when we bemoan Disney monoliths and Netflix disruption. This prevailed for Lionsgate, and you have to wonder, are they going to do more Benoit Blanc movies, or should Rian Johnson do more Benoit Blanc movies? I don't know. Will he get kicked out of Star Wars, Dave?
I mean, probably not. I don't think there's anything you could do to be kicked out of Star Wars, but it would be fun if he wants to. But also, I don't think it necessitates, becoming a series because it's popular. That seems.
I mean, like, he's talked about wanting to make more of them. I would enjoy it massively. I mean, especially there's this whole meta narrative to this movie of Rian Johnson, Chris Evans, and Daniel Craig all being like freed of their respective franchises to go have fun and make this movie. And I like that it can exist. I mean, Daniel Craig and Chris Evans are basically done with theirs. But I like it as a palate cleanser for the talent involved as well as the audiences who are sick of seeing franchise movies.
I mean, I would be interested in seeing that, like, a sort of anti-franchise, like, catch people as they come out. Like, the next one's, like, Daniel Craig and Daisy Ridley, like, solving a weird mystery on a boat.
Daisy Ridley was already in an Agatha Christie movie.
She was in Murder. They're making another one of those, too. Like, if they can make another one of that, make another Knives Out.
There you go.
Yeah. Save the franchises with another franchise. I like this.
It's a donut hole in a donut hole.
Oh, Knives Out is so good.
This week, for our final Go Deep segment, we're going to talk about a movie that I feel like people have been talking about for so many weeks in the silliest ways. And now we're going to get into the meat of The Irishman, the new film from Martin Scorsese. It is 3.5 hours long. I don't know why this is a problem for people.
Except you watched it in three sittings.
Which is totally fine. I watch it. I would 100% admit this. I watch it in three sittings. I'm not complaining about having 3.5 hours of Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Al Pacino, performing this grim, meditative mob saga that reminded me a lot of Mad Men more than, Goodfellas, probably. I saw so many people complaining about the runtime and complaining about. There was a viral tweet that was like, I think 43 minutes could be cut from this film. That's a very exact number. I don't know why anyone would come up with that assumption, because I did not find myself looking at my watch. I didn't find myself thinking about, like, why is this scene in here? Just get on with it. Get to the point. Like, the point is this amount of time that we're spending with Frank Sheeran, who we see in World War II, performing, like, getting Nazis to dig their own graves and shooting them in the chest, and then going to living in Philadelphia and delivering meat and becoming part of the mob, and then getting sucked into this world of brotherhood and unionship, collective action, and something that is really positive, and then, of course, something that has this dark underbelly. He is painting houses, as they say. He is knocking people off for the mob, and he is helping Jimmy Hoffa be a great union activist and be a slumlord connected to, you know, the mafia. He's stuck in this limbo for his entire life, and we're watching his entire life pass before him. Martin Scorsese infamously just hired Robert De Niro to do every part of Frank's life that we see in the movie, and they use de-aging technology to show some of the earlier scenes and some of the later scenes. I can't wait to talk about this with you two, because at no point was I like, this is really bad de-aging technology, or that I can really tell that this is CG stuff. What's going on? Mostly because I could not tell how old Frank was at any given moment in the film. It really didn't matter. We know that sometimes he's younger. We know when a flashback is happening. We can see his mind drifting through time. We definitely know when he's old Frank, because he's telling his story. That's kind of the bookends, or the narrative device
frame
that they
story.
Use. Yeah. He looks very old in a wheelchair with completely white hair. That's how I know Frank's old. Good visual trick, Martin Scorsese. He really made him look old in those scenes. But I can't say I was, like, blown away by The Irishman the way I may have been if I had seen it in theaters, for one hand, but on, you know, just these, like, definitely leaning, yeah, I just saw Uncut Gems, which Martin Scorsese produced, and that is an intense ticking clock of a movie. Couldn't be more different than The Irishman. And I'm not sure The Irishman would have ever knocked me out in any setting. I was happy to have it kind of wash over me and build to these final moments. And I think we should go full spoilers, since the movie's out on Netflix, maybe still in some theaters. But by the end of this movie, you've seen this guy's entire life, and it's just so fucking depressing. It's so sad to see a father, a good person, I think, deep down, corrupt his own life. Corrupt his own life and ruin and destroy every relationship and try and regain that and be such a failure in the end. Well, now Katie's going to take the top, because I've said that Frank Sheeran might be a good person.
Yeah, I still know that, like, I'm supposed to, like, feel sorry for him as, like, a good person who's been done wrong. Like, he made a bunch of terrible choices.
Done wrong. He created this life for himself. He's made his own choices. He's stomping out bodega owners to defend his daughter when he is a younger man, and he should not be doing that. But I still think that
passes comes down hard on curb stomping people.
Yeah, you know what? I just frown upon it. It's not my parenting style.
Yeah, for me, it was more about, like, I felt sorry for him, but also, like, feel sorry for the system, for the people who are kind of tangled up in it. Like, I think we can get into the role of women in this movie later, and, like, how they are the people who are tangled up in this world that doesn't actually have anything to do with them. So it's very sad, but I wasn't, like, I never thought of him as a good person. That was my only thing. Everything else you said was fine.
When I say he's a good person, I mean at the core. I mean that I believe that people start off as good people. I don't think... You know, he went to World War II. Do you think he's a good person when he's shooting German soldiers in the chest and burying them in the pits that they've dug out themselves? Is Frank Sheeran a good person
standards? I don't really care.
Put him on the Katie moral chart.
I don't want to, like. I think part of the point of The Irishman is not to pass moral judgment on people. Like,
correct.
These are people who are living in a system that's kind of the correct. Only thing they know how to do. Like, Frank, it's not like Frank is like, I want to be in the mafia. Like, it kind of comes to him, and he takes the situation that comes his way.
Right.
They don't know any other way to be in some way.
It's not gratuitous.
People like Jimmy Hoffa,
it's not
kind of able to create a whole system for themselves to succeed beyond that. Who then did a lot of good and did a lot of bad at the same time. I think that's an important part of it, is, like, there's a lot of bad things being done for bad reasons and a couple of good reasons too.
I mean, yeah, this is not, I do think that a movie like Goodfellas or Casino feels really slick and could possibly glorify the mafia from the wrong perspective. I don't think they actually do, but they're a different type of gangster movie than what The Irishman is going after. This is about being dutiful. This is about being loyal. And Frank paints houses, right? This is just something that he does and gets hired to do and feels like this is what he does in life. And when he gets called upon by his pal, Russell the man. Yeah. He has to do it, right? And that's wrong. That's not the right choice in life, but he cannot deviate from the path. And I think it becomes more disturbing as time goes on, especially when he eventually has to assassinate his very good friend, Jimmy Hoffa. It's depressing as hell to watch that scene where, and Martin Scorsese plays it out real long. And I, you know, there's been a lot of conversation about the length of this movie, but also praise for Scorsese's longtime editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, and, all credit goes to her. When you take the time to build a scene where Frank is told by Russ, like, we drove all the way out here so that you could take a plane to Detroit. And when you go to Detroit, you're going to get a car. And when you take the car, you're going to go pick Jimmy up. And then when you pick Jimmy up, you're going to bring him to the house, and then you're going to shoot him in the head. He doesn't say those specific words, because then we get to see every step of that way. And it really just cranks, right? This isn't done in montage over Russ's narration. We see every step. We feel there's a long conversation in the car ride to kill Jimmy, where him and his stepson, or Frank and Jimmy's stepson, are talking about fish. Right? Or,
oh my God. Just like, what kind left of fish?
Yeah, what kind of fish? It's just going on and on. And I could definitely see people who are maybe kind of paying attention or like tired or maybe misunderstanding this movie. I don't want to read too much into like why people have grievances, and maybe you two will have them. But like, that is an important scene because it's just building up to Frank having to kill his very good friend. It sucks. And they're talking about something so stupid, and it's funny. Like, this movie's really funny.
The thing about all of that to me is like, it's him knowing what he has to do, and it's him making the choice over and over again to do it. Like, it's not just like he takes the marching orders and he goes and does it. You watch him get on the plane, get off the plane, get in the car, like talk Jimmy into getting in the car. It's like, it's him, you know, in a way digging his own grave every step of the way and making that choice. Whoa. That I was talking about. Like, he chose this path for himself.
good metaphor. There's also a lot of great shots of Frank standing behind people. Like, how long is he going to wait before he has to shoot someone in the back of the head? And the Jimmy scene is one of the longest times where he almost hesitates. He might walk away from this job. Of course he doesn't. He can't. But I think Scorsese uses a lot of like shallow focus to make those moments scarier and more intense throughout the film. And to build a visual motif like that, yeah, maybe it needs to be 3.5 hours. I'm not here to say whether it should be or not, but like, it certainly worked for me. I think The Irishman's really successful at 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Dave, what did you think?
I think this movie's great. Dave, what do you think?
Yeah. I think that the last, from when Al Pacino enters the movie onward is fantastic. A lot of my problems with the movie is, I think, the cinematic tricks or the narrative tricks that were very similar to things like Goodfellas or Wolf of Wall Street that he's using to present this world are kind of tacked on, I think, to a performance that partially through de-aging, but I think also through some choices Robert De Niro makes, chooses to like define the character through negative space, which isn't a huge problem at the end of the movie because you've had to sit through 3 hours of the nuanced performance at that point when it, like, everything starts to peak. So I also love the entire, you know, Jimmy trip and the fish conversation and those moments. And then especially all the stuff with the older Joe Pesci later on, kind of showing some remorse in prison. All of that's like great. Him trying to, you know, talk to his daughters again is great. Like trying to find a priest, but not being able to like kind of admit that he's sorry. That's all great. I just wish there was less ambiguity in the beginning, where like the look on his face, the look on his fake face when he says he, you know, won't give up names because he lost like a thing of meat, ends up being like the same look on his face at some funerals later on. And so I just get lost in what the character's feeling. I'm never lost necessarily what I should be feeling about the character, but it does make my interest waft around when I don't have enough to anchor on, I think, to De Niro specifically. Hmm. And I've been trying to think about, maybe this is just a visual thing. So like the curb stomping scene, when I first, you know, saw it, I stopped it and I rewound it and watched it again, because it's obviously an old man Robert De Niro playing a young guy curb stomping, because the entire time he's stomping, his camera facing arm, his right arm is like bent, and then the wrist is bent in like old man Mr. Burns hands.
Yeah. That's like the scene where I noticed the physicality the most, for sure.
Yeah, and that sort of thing's like sort of around it, which is only because, and like the reason that Joe Pesci's de-aging works is because they de-age him back to an age that he wasn't in movies. So as far as I know, that's exactly what Joe Pesci looked like. And then, you know, bring him up sort of to like an older person. And then Al Pacino's works really well because Al Pacino isn't a very jowly aged man. And most of their problems with the facial de-aging in this movie, where you could tell, is where they have to reform the jawline into a young man's jawline. With Al Pacino, it just ends up being like some shading changes. So it all kind of looks good, is my thought just looking at it. But maybe I can't connect to that early De Niro stuff because something's getting wiped out in like the edge of the Uncanny Valley for me, because I just get nothing from his character until Jimmy Hoffa shows up and, you know, he realizes he's going to have to like kill him at the party, I think. The big
celebration party for him, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's like, finally I like plug into that character, because I think even Hoffa says at some point, like, it's hard to tell what you're thinking. So it's obviously a decision that De Niro's making to like let the voiceover and the obvious juxtaposition and editing and stuff like that build the character until he has to like come out and play. But it makes the first like half of the movie feel very long to me.
Can I posit a theory on the de-aging that Dave, as an expert, might be able to say more? I feel like De Niro is the only one I have a problem with the de-aging with, and it might just be the blue contacts. Like, they're so weird and make him look so strange, and I got used to it, and a lot of times you're not seeing how blue his eyes are, but that is the thing I found the most jarring.
It is very weird because that is, like, where you're looking, but I think it's, like, a combination. Okay, so if you're trying to read somebody's face, like, the principle of animation is you're looking at eyes and mouth, and those are both, like, therefore the hardest things to pull any sort of visual effect on. So if you're already trying to pull off like a very difficult visual effect and then you just throw some contacts on, I mean, like, the problem is we know what Robert De Niro looks like in those periods. And so the movie wants us to make the suspension of disbelief leap that we're watching this character, this Irishman, but he doesn't particularly ever like live that identity, and like, people just kind of say it, and it's like, but this is like young Vito Corleone, but with blue contacts. But like, he looks like old Vito Corleone because they didn't like try to make him
but
necessarily look
to be
like
young.
Young,
is he? Like,
yeah, he's supposed to be in like his mid 40s.
I thought this was more like Midnight Run era.
Yeah. But also, he doesn't really look like young Robert De Niro, which I like. Like, there's this thickness to Robert De Niro's face now that they keep for The Irishman, and he was like so rangy, like in Taxi Driver. And I don't mind that. Like, it feels like, you know, the real Frank Sheeran was like this huge, like 6'5", 250-pound guy. Like, I feel like it suits a character more than it wants us to believe that we're looking at past Robert De Niro.
Yeah, he has real dad energy from beginning to end in this movie. He really feels like, man, maybe this is our Philadelphia connection, Frank and I. But he just seems like this passive Philly dad who does what he's told and lives by these commandments where he has to protect his family in a specific way. It's just, he can be so passive and everyone steamrolls him. I don't know. That felt very familiar. I didn't really feel like I needed to get deep into Frank's psychology in this movie because he doesn't have much, to be honest.
No.
He is just a devout friend.
And you know so little about his backstory before he meets these guys, like how he got the job driving the truck. Why is he like in Philly? Like, he's Irish, but what is his Irish heritage? You don't know anything about that, like, except for him killing Nazis in World War II. And I think that's really deliberate too. Like, he's kind of born when the mafia picks him up.
Yeah, he has found a trade in killing, and he's been waiting for this moment, and he's been completely not energized, but like given direction. It's like pushing a ball down a ramp. That's Frank's life, and it's really grim to think about that, because Joe Pesci in this movie is really not enigmatic, but he's so energized in a way that I wasn't expecting. He's not frantic like some of his past characters. He just has this charisma where you really do believe that he could walk in any room and be the peace negotiator, or he could walk in a room and tell you to kill someone and you do it.
Yeah, he has
it's not intimidation. Yeah.
He's so good at this.
Yeah, I like Joe Pesci the best because I think he's the person that, you know, like understood what they were reaching for with like the time period thing, because he has the most distinct character. Like, young Joe Pesci in this movie is a like much more energetic character that moves differently. He gives like a Home Alone smile, like bending over the truck. And then old Joe Pesci is like a version of Joe Pesci I've never seen on screen before, like gumming, you know, a piece of bread and, you know, like dealing with like lots of, it seems like extra skin on his face. But the idea that he plays every like version of the age like slightly differently, like he's kind of getting like wiser and quieter, was like really my favorite part about the movie.
Yeah.
Katie, and I like you mentioned. Sorry. No, go.
I just like how the de-aging, like, it's, so you start and you're watching them, and at some point in the 70s, you see them as kind of oldish men, and then it flashes back to the beginning, and then, like, the de-aging, I guess, is subtle enough where, like, it's not happening as much that it kind of sneaks up on you when you catch up to the frame story of them in the car. Like, all of a sudden, they're in the middle age, and I was like, oh, wow, wait, I guess we've traveled that far, because, and then you realize that that is the day that they go to, that he gets sent to kill Jimmy Hoffa. I was impressed by how subtle the de-aging was to get us there. And that's another thing that if they had swapped them out for other actors, you wouldn't be able to accomplish and really made a case for using that technology.
I think some of it really works. I don't know. I like the movie, but it's not going to like be on my top 10. Is there something that like makes a similar barrier for either of you?
I really loved it. I think it's definitely going to be like in the mix for me. Ooh, yeah, it just really like the length of time sold me. And as I was telling you guys earlier, like the fact that it's about friendship and it's about this guy's relationship with these two different men, with Frank Sheeran's relationship with Jimmy Hoffa and Russell Bufalino, and how they both meant so much to him, and how eventually one forced him to betray the other, and how devastating that is, and then the fallout from that. Like it's a mob movie, but it's about feelings, and it's about how the mafia and unions are just kind of about like ways for men to build relationships with each other and kind of like find acceptance and love within like these, you know, straight man,
but poisonous
situation.
Love too. Like yeah, it's the like wrong way to build those.
Exactly. I mean, that's what, like, the whole party scene where it's this, like, banquet dinner for Frank Sheeran, where you kind of watch this series of conversations where it becomes clear that Jimmy Hoffa's going to die. And, you know, his daughter's watching this happen, which is a whole other thing. That whole scene is probably, like, 20 minutes long. It's amazing just watching how all of these relationships that you've been watching build up over the last 2 hours, like, kind of come to a head. It just pays off in so many ways.
Yeah, the movie really knocked me out. And I wasn't suspecting it. In the end, when they're really old, Russell and Frank are in jail. And they're really, really old. I mean, Joe Pesci's like playing old by being in a wheelchair.
Yeah, he's had a stroke.
And he's looking bad. And in that scene, he's still dwelling on the fact that he sent Frank to kill their friend, Jimmy Hoffa. And he's like, I wish it hadn't happened that way. But I did it in the end to protect you, because it's you and me, Frank. You and me.
That's
depressing as hell, because like, yeah, this is a movie about friendship and loyalty and the bonds that keep us going. And in the case of mobsters, as Scorsese emphasizes over and over and over again, not getting shot like 6 times in the face at some point in your like late 30s, early 40s. If you could make it to the age that they are, you will realize that you probably could have ended this shit so much earlier without so much blood on your fucking hands. And that's what's so depressing, that Russ tells Frank that he needed to kill Jimmy Hoffa so that those two could be in jail together and be friends in the end. It's like, maybe you could have just not killed anyone.
Yeah. And you think about them like earning the right to grow old after they denied it of so many other people, and how kind of cosmically unfair that is.
Yeah. I mean, it's at the top of this conversation, we're talking about are they good or bad? It's like, it's not really the question. It's they have good feelings and they are good friends, but they've done so much bad.
Jimmy Hoffa's family is presented as mourning, like being the last people left mourning. So there is like some idea of like the families that. That is their hell.
And Frank
they have
still
to, like,
won't give them closure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have to come to full realization about it and still be like impotent about it.
Yeah.
Which presumably, because that's what we see happens to him in church, we're supposed to assume something similar could have happened to Russ before, because he gets rolled into the church and then rolled into the hospital and rolled in the grave.
Wait, what do you presume happens to him in church?
Like, I don't think either of them, I don't think anybody repents. I think that's the,
I know,
the
I didn't
curse
think so
of all
either.
Of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going long, but I feel like there's two big things left to talk about. One is Al Pacino in this movie. What did you think of Al Pacino?
Loved him.
he's
turned
all the way up.
He's turned all the way up, but he's also got this like warmth to the character. Like you like being around Jimmy Hoffa. You get why he's so charismatic. It's not just making big speeches. It's like being this appealing presence. Like you want to be his friend in the same way that, that Frank Sheeran does. Like I love all the scenes from them in the hotel rooms where they're just kind of like talking to each other about their lives. I thought he was so great.
I like that scene where someone tries to shoot Jimmy Hoffa in court and then his son, played
Jesse Plemons.
By Jesse Plemons, tackles him, and then there's still like a prolonged aftermath of that. It's like, what did I tell you guys? You always tackle someone who's coming with your gun, but don't tackle anyone. Run away from a knife.
Charge a gun.
That's, you get sucked into that. That's pure charisma. That's hilarious. Or when he's screaming at everyone, that's really fun too. And pure Pacino, and that's, I guess, maybe indulging a little bit, but worth it. It's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, that scene where he's screaming at all of them for letting someone's son pay off his... I don't remember what the situation was, where he's like, you're going to send me out of jail, and then De Niro tries to like walk out in a huff, and like, oh, that scene is... It's so funny. This movie is devastating and hilarious.
And then the wrap-up, I mean, this is a big... You mentioned it earlier, Katie, that there's been a lot of criticism, at least on Twitter. I'm trying to find like a great piece written by one of our colleagues on this topic, but a lot of people were kind of raised eyebrow over Anna Paquin in this movie, plays Peggy Sheeran, Frank's daughter, who she maybe has 6 or 7 words of dialogue in this movie. She appears quite a bit, and so does her younger counterpart. And she spends most of the movie just watching her father and being devastated about his inability to communicate, his inability to act like a human being, and then this shadow life that he lives that everyone knows what he does. He comes home maybe 3 or 4 times throughout the movie to TV broadcasts about like who's dead. There's a scene where they all come home and like Jimmy Hoffa has just been killed, and he's like drinking a whiskey. He's like, I guess I should call his wife. And everyone knows what's going on, and she just sits mostly silent throughout the whole movie, staring at him, and he eventually admits that he never got her back. He could never reel her back in and have a relationship with her. And he eventually has a conversation with his other daughter about why they do that. And I feel like that puts the point, Scorsese makes the point very clear about why Anna Paquin does not have lines in this movie. But what do you two make of kind of sidelining female voices in this movie?
I want to let Dave talk because I pretty much agree with you.
I think that it's the same thing I was saying when I said earlier, my problem with this movie is defining him in negative space. Even though we get to see his actions, a lot of the things with his wives and with his daughters, if we don't see it, we're supposed to kind of like assume that he doesn't remember it, or it's not important to like this story, or that absence is also noticed by him, and it's like something like that, which I feel like with Anna Paquin's character, it's definitely there. It's just with the other ones in his life that sort of get shunted off. There's some smoking wives that are very funny, in terms of the first third of the movie, but then, later when they like come back, they're like, you know, for the smoking, it's like basically talking over the fact that Jimmy Hoffa will have already been dead. So there is like another point in the movie where Hoffa's wife, I think, is about to start a car, and the movie intercuts her thinking about other cars that she knows her husband has blown up. And I think that is like the most effective moment for like a female character in the movie, because it's not that I don't see what they did with Anna Paquin's character. It seems like, they had to pick a daughter, and they did, and like there are also other daughters. So, like, it seems in a 3.5-hour movie, it's somewhat exclusionary.
You wanted more time. You wanted it to be 4 hours.
It picked its time, what it spent on, very specifically to form like this narrative. I just think that it leaves like some gaps for the women in the story. But I guess it's not really their story until it becomes, oh, weren't they there?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like
how it is at the end.
I feel like your choice in a movie like this is you kind of try to make up for the historical lack of women in these worlds by like emphasizing them in the story somehow and kind of giving them something to do, even if maybe it wouldn't have happened that way in real life. Or you kind of highlight the fact that they had no place in this world by cutting to Anna Paquin and by showing the wives on this road trip kind of like chatting in the background and how sidelined they are. Like, I don't know. It's not revolutionary to be like, oh, well, you know, the women weren't in this real part of the story, so we just can't have them in there. But I feel like the highlighting of it and the casting of Anna Paquin in that role specifically just does something to say, like, here's another thing that's fucked up about this world. It's all men making all these dumb decisions, and like they have wives and daughters and family members who they're completely leaving aside for the sake of this bullshit. And Anna Paquin's face kind of sums up so much of that.
When there's that scene with Jimmy Hoffa and his wife, when his wife's like, you know, you gotta take Pro and like, you know, stomp him out after you become president of the union again.
Oh yeah.
Didn't you just like want, like, didn't you just like want a little hint from Al Pacino that she planned the assassination of the president or like something? Don't you just like want that extra little, but there was also like, there was a woman behind the man for one of these people?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't mind. I forgot about that part with Jimmy Hoffa's wife. She did seem like a firecracker. I wanted to read a biography of Jimmy Hoffa after this.
Oh, I definitely do too. Also, because Java was like, well, what did they say about the good things he did for the union? And I'm like, well, kind of wasn't about that.
Yeah, Patches, as a labor organizer yourself, how did you feel about the pro-union aspects of this?
Yeah, I feel like I didn't involve myself enough in the mob and get the perks that I could have when I was more union-focused with my time. Very disappointed.
All contract perks, no mob perks.
Why didn't I have any thugs who went out and did my business for me? I need a guy who paints houses.
Dumbest question. What did the union get out of the mob other than like have them beat up non-union truck drivers once in a while? Like, what was the benefit of that relationship?
Weren't they, so there was the pension laundering. That's a big thing too, right?
Like, yeah, no, I mean, like, really, so the pension was going to the mobsters, and I guess presumably they were getting a bunch more money back than they could have gotten through somewhere else. But like,
yeah, they're keeping things, keeping the status quo in check, right? I don't know. I've always had an issue with like figuring out what the mob does.
I know.
Especially in movies. I'm like, what is your plot here? You just go up to people and throw up your fist and they give you money, or how does it work?
I mean, that's like that sequence where like Pesci's like stopping at every store on this one road and just getting an envelope of cash. It's like, wow. That you really just set up a retirement fund for yourself.
Yeah, The Irishman is actually the clearest it's ever been for me in terms of like what the mob really does and how they protect people and how they enforce their rules and how they create this kind of parallel law in a city. I still your question about like how does the union collaborate with the mob?
What does the union get out of it is the question I don't feel like is fully answered. But maybe
we'll get that rewatch time for Irishman rewatch.
The Irishman. It's on Netflix. We all think you should give it. It's this year's Roma. You might be on your couch, but don't look away, Irishman. Well, I guess come back at least three times, Irishman.
That does it for this week's Fighting the War Room. We'll be back next week, maybe continuing to argue about The Irishman, or Patches will forget we talked about it, and we'll talk about it again. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I'm Matt Patches, senior editor at Polygon. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches, and I just want to say that I also remembered something that has to do with our first segment, which is we were talking about the movies that have disappeared, but now I'm thinking about the people who have disappeared, and I want to hold on to this. What the hell happened to Channing Tatum and Joseph Gordon-Levitt? They were going to do a movie.
They were going to do a Guys and Dolls.
Guys and Dolls together. And now neither of them exists on this plane. But, yeah, rough reality.
I'm saying Channing Tatum has a better chance at a comeback. But
I just watched the first Joseph Gordon-Levitt project I've watched in maybe like 3 or 4 years. And it was the 50th anniversary of Sesame Street on HBO. He's the star of it for some reason. And that's how I knew something was wrong with these guys.
I think they both just need one good swing and they'll be fine.
Anyway.
You mean Gambit? You mean Gambit for the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
All right.
It could happen. He's probably on contract.
We'll see.
Anyway, fightingintheworm.com.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find my coverage of The Mandalorian at Thrillist.com. We're talking about Star Wars on the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. I know it makes the name weird, but our advertisers are like, you can't keep changing the name every 6 months. How are we going to sell your show? So all the people who think they're selling on a Lost show are selling on a Star Wars show. Join us.
I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at VanityFair.com and on Little Gold Men podcast, where this week Joanna Robinson, friend to all, talked to Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez, who made the earworms from Frozen 2 that I can't get out of my head. So maybe she'll punish them for their sins. You can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRCH. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where you can tweet at us about The Irishman or anything you want, or answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Little Joe, what's cinema's most memorable plant?
Oh, sorry, I took the yawn. Oh, thanks for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week. And when you're done, I'll make you do it all again. Ooh.
Oh, oh, oh,
Bum-ba-dum, the tum-pum-dum, a pum-pum-dum, the gung-gung-dum, ba-bum-ba-bum-ba-bum, now I'm done, we're done.